Before I begin, I do want to acknowledge my team of excellent collaborators at UW-Madison, especially Jonathan Patz and Tracy Holloway, and postdocs Jason Vargo and Monica Hartke. So today's talk, I'm going to share some of the work that we've been doing in Madison to model exposures to extreme heat and air pollution triggered by climate change at the middle of the century in the United States. And before I jump in, I have nothing to disclose. And before I begin, I want to draw attention to a document that received a fair bit of attention at last night's town hall, the National Climate Assessment, which is a really great resource for any of you interested in climate science and especially health impacts. So this is a figure from this national assessment, which was released earlier this spring, which draws attention to the problem of global warming, which I'm sure a lot of you are already familiar with. So this figure outlines the decadal temperature average across the globe from the last century or so, and points out that over the last five decades, we've seen a progressive rise in the Earth's average surface temperature. And you can see that that warming is accelerating. We know in public health that extreme temperatures are already associated with adverse health effects in populations worldwide. We saw a dramatic example of this in 2003 in a heat wave that killed an estimated 70,000 in Western Europe, and more recently in 2010, where a month-long heat wave in Russia killed an estimated 15,000 people. And so those are sort of acute exposures to extreme heat, which we know are associated with adverse health effects. But we also know that chronic exposures over an entire season, so elevated temperatures over many months, are also associated with adverse health outcomes in human populations. And so it was some of the work that we're doing to get at this more chronic exposure to extreme heat and what that means in terms of public health. The second exposure that I'm going to discuss in this talk is that of air pollution, which is by far the most important environmental risk factor in terms of public health. This headline draws attention to the problem of ambient air pollution, which was recently ranked by the Global Burden of Disease Project as the ninth leading risk factor for disease and early death around the world. Air pollution is a problem especially in developing countries, but even in the United States, millions of Americans live in areas that exceed the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, the standards that the Environmental Protection Agency administers to protect human health and the environment. So we know that climate change presents a host of risks to public health. I'm going to focus on these two exposures. In fact, one of the key take-home points from today will be that climate change is potentially, you know, has the potential to basically swamp and diminish the gains that we've made over the past several decades in terms of improving air quality, especially in the United States. So the key sort of question driving the modeling work that we've been conducting is how climate change will affect exposures to extreme heat and air pollution in the United States at the middle of the century. And I want to explain some of the sort of background in terms of the exposures that we're looking into. So this is another quote from that National Climate Assessment document, which draws attention to the sort of new climate regime that we're experiencing in areas around the world. The report notes that extended periods of unusual heat now last much longer than any living American has ever experienced. And so that means that we're faced with the challenge of trying to predict what that means in terms of health impacts. To do that, we're conducting a sequence of modeling to estimate environmental exposures and connect those to anticipated health outcomes. I want to step you through that modeling process. So we start with a regional climate change scenario for the eastern United States, which is built on science from the National Center for Atmospheric Research out in Boulder, Colorado, and is associated with a particular emission scenario, which I'll detail in a second. We use that climate change scenario to drive estimates of future summer climate in a particular portion of the United States, and use that information in estimates of ambient temperature exposures to come up with our health impact estimates. So we're using information from the North American Climate Change Assessment Program, or NARCAP, which is the information from NCAR out in Colorado. And we're running our own models in Madison, including the Weather Research and Forecasting Model, the WARF model, and I'll focus especially on this final model here for health impact analysis called BenMap. How many of you have heard of BenMap? Okay, a few. So a lot of you know that BenMap has traditionally been used in the area of air pollution risk assessment, and it's more recently been applied in the last few years to better constrain estimates of chronic exposure to extreme heat. So this is some exciting new work. So I explained that NARCAP source of data. So this is basically the foundation upon which our health impact assessments for both extreme heat and air pollution are based. NARCAP is a program run by NCAR to basically come up with regional data appropriate for the scale of health impact analyses. A lot of you have seen a figure like this published by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which basically draws attention to the range of scenarios we might see by the end of the century in terms of the level of warming. So you can see that we have the black line, which corresponds to the instrumental record of temperature around the world. And at the year 2000, that line diverges into a range of colored lines. These represent different scenarios, which correspond to different levels of greenhouse gas emissions from countries around the world. So that orange line, for example, represents a relatively optimistic scenario, right, in which we see a leveling off of greenhouse gas emissions and associated plateau of warming. Unfortunately, it looks like we're more closely at this point headed towards that red line, which is a pretty dramatic scenario of warming by the end of the century, somewhere around 3 to 4 degrees centigrade by the year 2100. It's important to point out, though, that that's a global average, right? So there are going to be places that experience warming that's outside of that specific range. So all of the scenarios that this NRCAP program uses are built on the A2 emission scenarios. That's an important thing to keep in mind when we discuss health impacts down the line. When we talk about health impact assessment, we have to use sort of a baseline case as a point of departure and understand where things might change into the future. So for our work, we've chosen the year 2007 as one that's representative of environmental conditions across the eastern United States, which is pretty broadly defined from this map. So for all the data that I'll show you, 2007 is sort of our point of departure in terms of exposures to heat and air pollution. We could have chosen a different year. There's many different years to consider, but we feel this is a pretty representative sample of where things are at currently. So this is our estimate of what 2007 temperatures looked like across the study region. And we can use that NRCAP information and the weather research and forecasting model to come up with an estimate of what temperatures look like in the future. So this is the same map into the year 2050 in the middle of the century, and you can see we experienced significant warming across most of the region. So the temperature scales in these maps are the same, so you can see pretty significant warming. I'll point out here that the grid resolution is especially important in estimates like this. So every pixel on this map corresponds to a 12 kilometer by 12 kilometer box. So we've downscaled information from the NRCAP program from a 50 kilometer box down to a 36 kilometer box, all the way down to a 12 kilometer box. There's ways to go even further, of course, but that's especially computationally demanding in terms of the human resources and computing resources to run the model over space and time for many years. So we can do some simple math and subtraction in these two maps to come up with an estimate of how much warming we might expect to see by the middle of the century across the study region. You can see that it's pretty dramatic. In terms of apparent temperature, which incorporates the effects of both temperature exposures and humidity, we expect about a 4.5 degree centigrade average increase across the study region. And we also looked at minimum temperature because that's another important metric to consider in terms of human health risks. Minimum temperature is expected to increase by more than 3 degrees centigrade. And minimum temperature is experienced typically overnight and allows our bodies to dissipate heat, so it's an especially important metric to consider. We looked at these two metrics. There's a whole host of other metrics to consider, and there was a good discussion last night in terms of how we define heat waves, and there's sort of a lot of disagreement about that in literature. But there's ways to work from these estimates and come up with health impact estimates. So this is some of the health impact results. This is using that BEMMAP model, which I'll explain a little bit further in the air pollution discussion. So what we've done is applied exposure response functions from time series studies of exposure, chronic exposure to extreme heat. So those two studies are listed on the left. They apply to the entire study population, which is more than 240 million Americans by the middle of the century. So you can see those corresponding temperature increases that I just showed on the last map. So we used these time series studies and the risk estimates along with demographic information and background health incidence information embedded within the BEMMAP health model that EPA uses to come up with estimates of the number of extra deaths we might expect to see as a result of chronic exposures to higher temperatures in the future. And you can see that they're pretty dramatic, somewhere between 5,800 and 8,800 extra deaths by the middle of the century. These estimates apply to the entire population of 240 million Americans across the study region in the future. But we also know that there are specific populations of concern, especially the elderly, to consider. So we applied a separate risk estimate from another study in that third row there, which applies to a smaller population of about 48.6 million Americans. The risk estimate is higher because we know that this is an especially vulnerable group, and we see an estimated more than 11,500 extra deaths by the middle of the century just due to chronic exposures over the summer months, which for our study ran from June through August. So I'll jump from the heat work to our work on air pollution. It's really these temperature exposures that are driving changes in air pollution patterns. So I want to highlight another quote from the National Climate Assessment, which draws attention to the problem of urban air pollution and the role that climate change may play in exacerbating these exposures in cities especially. So we know that key climate drivers of health impact include these exposures to extreme heat because many air pollutants are tied to environmental conditions, especially ozone and particulate matter. So right now, as I mentioned, millions of Americans live in areas exceeding air quality standards for ozone and PM. So ozone, for example, 120 million, million Americans live in counties exceeding those standards, and for particulate matter, so these really tiny particles that can penetrate deep into the respiratory tract, about 70 million Americans live in counties exceeding the standard for that pollutant. Ozone is tightly linked to climatic conditions, right, because it's a secondary pollutant formed in the atmosphere through the interaction of primary emissions of nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds. So it's highly sensitive to environmental conditions. We know that in warmer weather, we see, in general, higher ozone concentrations in cities. For particulate matter, we know that warmer weather will trigger stagnant air masses across the mid-latitudes worldwide. Rainfall is the primary means by which PM is removed from the air that we breathe. And so when we see less frequent precipitation events, we expect to see an accumulation of these particulates in the air that we breathe. So I've sort of outlined some of the direct effects in terms of how climate change is linked or is thought to be linked to increases in air pollution. In addition to the temperature relationship for ozone in terms of the nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds that combine in the presence of sunlight and form ozone, there's also a natural source of emissions to consider. So there are plant emissions of these volatile organic compounds that play a significant role in ozone concentrations. And we know that warmer weather actually triggers higher emissions of VOCs from plants. So we may do nothing on the human side in terms of precursor emissions for ozone, but expect to see changes in ozone concentrations due to this biogenic piece. And this is really an important thing to consider in incorporating it into our exposure estimates in the models. In terms of PM 2.5, how many of you have heard of this pollutant before I go any further? Okay, most of you are familiar with it. But basically, PM 2.5 is both primarily emitted from tailpipes and smokestacks, et cetera, but it's also formed secondarily in the atmosphere, just like ozone is. And that's why we're especially concerned in terms of warmer conditions. In addition to the stagnant air masses and precipitation frequency that I just discussed just a second ago, there's also this biogenic piece to consider in terms of PM 2.5. So the same biogenic emissions that are associated with the ozone formation can also potentially be associated with PM 2.5 formation. So it's important to consider this natural piece in addition to the human emissions. So these are sort of the direct effects of warming, right? But there's an important indirect effect to consider, and that's one of this energy demand. So we know that, thanks to Dr. Knowlton and others in this room, I'm sure, who've pointed out that warmer weather is expected to trigger higher use of electricity, especially in developed settings. And it's an important feedback loop to consider because in places like the United States, where we still rely on coal for about 40% of our electricity, that's a significant contributor to air pollution emissions. So this pie chart from the Energy Information Administration draws attention to the issue of space cooling, right? So when it's warmer outside, people are using more air conditioning, and if we're using polluting fossil fuel to provide electricity, then we're going to expect higher emissions in the future. It's estimated that U.S. commercial and residential buildings use about 15% of their energy for space cooling, so this is actually a significant effect to consider. So we're working to quantify both the indirect and direct effects of climate change on air pollution and human health. So just to draw sort of a picture of what that looks like in terms of the modeling, we're concerned with climate and air quality models and connecting that with BenMap to health risks, but also considering how warmer weather triggers changes in energy demand, what that in turn means for emissions from power plants, et cetera, and what those downstream emissions, that feedback loop, means for public health. And this is really one of the first times that we've been able to quantify the indirect effect, because it's one that's been posited in the literature, but as you can imagine, modeling electricity demand, and especially modeling emissions from power plants, is an extraordinarily difficult effort, because each power plant is different, renewable portfolio standards in each state are different, the energy mix in the middle of the century is sort of anyone's guess, right? But we've done our best to quantify this effect. So I'm going to focus, especially for the rest of this talk, on the direct mechanism, because that's the work that's final, but we're in the process of finalizing the indirect effects, and I'm happy to talk about that modeling when we're done. So this is a similar sort of diagram in terms of outlining the modeling that we've been doing in terms of the heat, but we've added another piece here, right? So we're starting at the very top with that NARCAP same A2 emission scenario. We've chosen a especially warm summer in the future to demonstrate sort of the height of warming that could be reasonably expected through these models. We've run them again through that weather research and forecasting model, and then another model that EPA uses, the Community Multiscale Air Quality Model, to focus on those two air pollutants that I mentioned earlier, ozone and PM2.5. Finally, BenMap comes into play finally at the end in estimating the excess mortality and morbidity that we might expect from future exposures to air pollution just due to warming. So here are the results for ozone and PM2.5. So we're going to again start in the year 2007 as our point of departure. You can see that a number of places are already experiencing areas outside of the ozone attainment. So anything that's orange or red is an area that's experiencing levels above 75 parts per billion, the current eight-hour standard as administered by EPA. So this is the point of departure. We end up with higher concentrations in the future at the middle of the century. Again, you can see sort of a dramatic increase, especially in areas downwind from cities. Ozone has a longer residence time in the atmosphere than PM2.5, and so it's especially communities that are downwind from power plants, et cetera, that we're thinking about in work like this. So we can do, again, some simple math, do some subtraction, and come up with estimates of how much extra ozone we might expect to see as a result of climate change. And here the estimate is pretty dramatic, about 15 parts per billion. I mentioned that the standard is about 75 parts per billion for the eight-hour consideration, so that's about a fifth of the standard just due to warming alone. For PM2.5, unfortunately, the story is similarly bleak. So we start off with year 2007 concentrations. We fast forward into the future using that CMAQ model to estimate PM2.5 exposures across the region at a 12-kilometer resolution. The increase here is about 3.8 micrograms per cubic meter. The relevant standard, that's the annual standard, is 12 micrograms. So again, we're seeing pretty dramatic increases in the future just due to warming alone. And you can see here that the biogenic piece, especially in the southeastern U.S., is an important consideration to make. So we use this air pollution information to drive the BenMap model. And I mentioned sort of the results from BenMap earlier, but I wanted to step you through really the beauty of this model in integrating data from the environmental and health sectors to come up with risk estimates. So we start with these baseline and future estimates of environmental exposures, whether they be exposures to extreme heat or more traditionally air pollution in this model. We combine that with information on population, right? So I mentioned 240 million Americans in this study region in the future. We need to think about where people are going to be moving or might be moving based on our best available census estimates and where they might be at the middle of the century. In terms of conducting a risk estimate in epidemiology, we need to understand what the current rate of disease is across the country, and especially because a lot of chronic disease is related to air pollution exposures. So we're thinking about things like heart disease, heart attacks, cancer, stroke, et cetera, incidence that is already on the rise in many of these areas around the United States. So we're using background disease, mortality, and morbidity incidence rates to drive this model. The real beauty of MedMap, though, is in applying these exposure response functions. So there's, of course, a whole wealth of evidence in air pollution epidemiology in linking PM2.5 and ozone exposures on a chronic basis to adverse health outcomes. And it's really the work of BenMap to use that exposure response information and use a bunch of meta-analyses to basically come up with estimates of, you know, if we saw this exposure response function in the past and we apply a new estimate of exposure in the future, what kind of health risks might we see? So it's really combining these various sources of data, both environmental and human health, and epidemiologic, to come up with estimates of health impacts in terms of morbidity and mortality. And I'm happy to talk about BenMap more offline. So using the exposure estimates that I just showed you on those pretty dramatic maps, we can come up with estimates of health impacts due to heightened exposures to PM2.5 and ozone. So again, we see a pretty dramatic increase in the concentration of this pollutant, almost 4 micrograms per cubic meter. And through this model, we come up with an estimate that's about 63,000 excess deaths attributable to PM2.5 exposure across just the study region. The current rate of PM2.5-related deaths in the U.S. is estimated somewhere between 63,000 and 80,000 or so deaths. So this represents roughly a doubling of the air pollution-related burden of disease from PM2.5. We can do the same sort of math on ozone concentrations. The excess death estimate, so this is the number of deaths beyond what we would expect to see from air pollution exposures, is dramatic at more than 8,000. The beauty of BenMap is really in incorporating a whole host of dose response estimates. So here we're applying the exact same dose response information that EPA is using in its regulatory impact analyses to come up with estimates of other impacts in terms of human morbidity. This is a session on emergency response, and so I'll point out that, you know, especially cardiovascular problems, things like non-fatal heart attacks, are expected to rise by a significant portion in the future just due to warming alone. I will wrap it up pretty soon with just these key points. So I mentioned some substantial warming that we expect to see through this A2 emission scenario in NARCAP. We think it's a pretty reasonable representation of where things are headed in terms of emissions, but this does represent sort of a particular choice of scenario in the future. I mentioned just now the PM2.5 estimates in terms of mortality represent roughly a doubling of the air pollution-related burden of disease. So this is a pretty significant impact just due to warming alone, so we're not considering that indirect energy sector feedback at all. The seasonal heat-related mortality is on par with ozone impact, so that's a consideration that's not often made in terms of the relative importance of air pollution and environmental exposures from extreme heat. We know that these exposures are experienced simultaneously, right? So on warm days, people are exposed to higher ozone levels. And so it's an important consideration to be made in terms of future work and combining these coincident exposures. And I'll just point out again that these are only the direct effects that we've considered, so we haven't incorporated any of the indirect energy sector modeling into these estimates just yet. So with that, I'll thank you for your time. I think we might have a second for questions. That's a great question. So in terms of running CMAQ, you have to include emissions inventories, which account for human emissions as sort of a baseline case. And so we use the same emissions for 2007 into the future. So those are incorporated into the estimates in terms of the emissions inventory for 2007, and those are not changed in the future. Right, so we're incorporating the changing energy sector information into the indirect modeling. This sort of direct piece only considers sort of a stagnant piece of human emissions from 2007. Right, so we'll be able to sort of tease out the effect of, you know, say if we closed half of the coal-fired power plants, et cetera, where would that energy come from? It's the MyPower model at UW-Madison. Paul Meyer is sort of the head sort of energy modeler for us. But we are working to sort of adapt to changing conditions in the energy sector and electricity generation to incorporate those changing emissions into the indirect piece. So stay tuned.
One more question, and then we'll talk more at the end. Go ahead. I'm wondering if you're
Right. So the first question, in terms of wildfire, yes. So the CMAQ modeling that we've done has considered the wildfire emissions of PM2.5. But those have not responded to climate specifically, right? So we're just considering, again, a stagnant sort of estimate for those. And yes, so it's great to point out. So for the health impact estimates, those are annualized. So this is for the middle of the century somewhere. It gets a little sort of in the weeds in terms of the exact year, but we're calling it 2050 in terms of the NARCAP estimate. All right, thank you.